check back RS Interview. V APR intervjuju danes gostimo Aleksandro Halkin, ki je pred več kot 25 leti v sodelovanju z lokalnimi zapatističnimi skupnosti v mehičkem Chiapasu ustanovila Chiapas Media Project, organizacijo zdaj znano pod imenom Pro Medios de Comunicación Comunitaria. Organizacija je vzpostavila medijske centre staroselskih skupnosti za produkcijo videoposnetkov in dokumentiranje življenja skupnosti. Zapatisti, staroselski potomci Majov, tudi sicer za priseženje avtonomnemu organiziranju političnega življenja, so si nadeli ime po Emiliano Zapati, revolucionarju, ki se je v začetku 20. stoletja boril za razlaščene kmete. Z uporom v Chiapasu, najrevnejšem delu Mehike, so zapatisti uradno začeli leta 1994. V intervjuju z Aleksandro Halkin nas zanima, kakšne medijske vsebine zapatisti proizvajajo in kako so njihove medijske organizacije financirane. Začenjamo z vprašanjem, kako so v Mehiki organizirani staroselski mediji.
Well, I don't know if I could speak in general terms because our project was very specific to a very specific moment in time. You know, I know that there are, I think now what I can say is that when we started in the late 90s working with the Zapatista communities, portable consumer video technology was just becoming affordable. And that was why we were able to create the Chiapas Media Project Pro Medios, because we could afford to buy this equipment. And now what's happened is that there is, you know, a new generation. In particular, I can talk about a new generation in Chiapas of indigenous filmmakers that are making feature documentaries, for example. And they're recognized in Mexico. Their films are being shown all over the world. And so there is kind of like individual authorship now, instead of just like how we were working, which was much more community-based, much more focused on the Zapatista movement and how they were organizing communities. But I can't really speak to the larger, more general way that indigenous media is organized in Mexico, because I haven't really been working in it.
Is this Chiapas Media Project, is it still active in any way?
Yeah, what happened was the project, when it first started in the late 90s, was called the Chiapas Media Project. It's always been binational. And then in 2002, it was formalized in Mexico as a Mexican NGO called Pro Medios de Comunicación Comunitaria, but we call it Pro Medios for short. And Pro Medios has been working in Chiapas ever since. And, you know, we stopped working with the Zapatista communities, I think around 2015, more or less. But they've continued to do workshops with indigenous communities and organizations, as well as non-indigenous organizations, doing audiovisual training, that kind of thing. And in the last 3 years, what's happened, which is very exciting, is we've been able to secure funding to begin to organize our video archive, which has over 1,400 videotapes in it. And so we've been able to do an inventory, create metadata, and now we're beginning to digitize it. And that is kind of why I'm here in Slovenia, because we've been able to digitized some of the Zapatista productions, some of the earlier footage that we shot. And so now what's happening is we're starting to develop a feature documentary based on our archive in Chiapas, which holds very unique, never before seen footage shot by myself, Promedios, the Zapatista communities, and other people that we collaborated with over the years.
That's the project that's happening, that's in the making, right?
Yeah, so it's been really interesting. I mean, it's been an issue that has been on my mind for about 20 years. Because once I started seeing the productions that the communities were making and the footage that we were shooting documenting different public events or celebrations, and seeing the videotapes kind of stack up in the office, I realized, uh-oh, you know, how are we going to be able to preserve this footage? This is really historic. And so it's taken 20 years for us to be able to secure funding. And we received funding from IMCINE, which is part of the Mexican Ministry of Culture, funds cinematic projects. We've also received funding from the University of California in Los Angeles, which has this endangered media archiving project. We've also got support from the APEX program, which is a video preservation program at New York University in New York. They've come to Chiapas and done workshops with us and also have brought us kind of key pieces of equipment that we've needed in order to digitize, and also kind of really talked us through the APEX program, as well as this French academic who teaches at the University of Paris in Nanterre. He's also come down and assisted us in creating the inventory, like helped us label all the videotapes, right? So that we could then be able to digitize them and have it very organized. So we've been extremely lucky to have mostly all this volunteer support. We've also had interns. We have a program, an internship program in Germany. I can't remember which university it is, where they've sent interns that have been really critical in creating the metadata for the archive, as well as some local university students who've interned with us. So for us, it's really exciting to be able to see this footage from the beginning of the project, you know, from the late 90s. For me personally, I wasn't sure I would ever have access to this footage, and to be able to see it and kind of go back in time, you know, and see footage that the communities have shot and this other footage, it really has been profound and really kind of, what's the word? Like impressed upon us the value of what we have, because there really isn't any other organization or institution in the region or anywhere that has the footage that we have.
Yeah. You mentioned financing, and I also wanted to ask you, how is it financed? Is there any state-backed program?
Indigenous media in Mexico, at least with video production, really started in the late 80s with support from the National Indigenous Institute, which was part of the Mexican government. And it was a technology transfer program where they went into indigenous communities and did, you know, I don't know, they did really long workshops. Sometimes I think they were like a month long, and they brought equipment, and it was, you know, basically, you know, if you went to film school, you know, how to organize a shot, how to, you know, think about shooting for editing. And so that technology transfer began in the late 80s. So the Mexican government, you know, in one way or the other, has kind of been instrumental in supporting indigenous media production in Mexico. You know, we, up until the archive, never received any financing from the Mexican government, partially because of the politics of the Zapatista movement, really rejecting any kind of state support. But now that we're not working with Zapatistas in an institutional way, you know, we have relationships with individual Zapatista filmmakers that we've known for many, many years. You know, now we feel it's appropriate to get this financing. I mean, it's also the only way that we're going to be able to protect this footage. You know, at the beginning of the project in the late 90s, I think the Mexican government didn't really care about what we were doing, because I think their attitude was, well, what would they be, you know, what videos could they possibly be making that would actually make any difference? And, you know, it was very interesting because, you know, the Zapatista videos had worldwide distribution. I mean, their videos won prizes in Russia, you know, at environmental film festivals. They were shown, they've been shown all over the world. And so they actually did have quite, you know, far-reaching effects, much more than I think the Mexican government ever could have possibly imagined. When I started the project, I was no expert on indigenous media in Latin America. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and so I kind of looked at the project as, you know, creating filmmakers, you know, my peers. And the way the distribution ended up happening was I just thought, well, why not send these films to film festivals? You know, and I would write to these film festivals and say, look, we're a nonprofit, we're working with these communities, we don't really have any money to pay entrance fees. Is it okay if we send you these films? And they would say yes, and they would end up getting in to these film festivals. It was really kind of, I think, the first time in Latin America, at least, where it wasn't confined to kind of an indigenous media section of a film festival, right? We just sent it, and they could play it wherever they wanted to. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think before then, a lot of the indigenous media production in Latin America was kind of relegated to this very particular section and not kind of integrated into the broader film festival structure. So I think with our project, just because I would just send it to random film festivals, I was just like, why not? And it was really interesting to see how many film festivals their films got into.
Mm.
Yeah.
So Zapatistas, they reject any state funding in general.
They have been. You know, they had an uprising in 1994, on January 1st, 1994, and an armed uprising where they took over 6 towns in the state of Chiapas and basically declared war on the Mexican government. They chose that day because that was the day that NAFTA was going into effect, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and they knew that NAFTA was going to have really detrimental effects on poor people in general, but indigenous people in particular. And so they used that to kind of launch their movement. And one of the things that they asked for really early on during the San Andreas Accords, which was kind of this negotiation that was going on between them and the Mexican government, there was a ceasefire, and they were trying to kind of negotiate like certain considerations from the Mexican government. And one of them was access to their own communication technology. And so that's kind of where the Chiapas Media Project fit in. They were asking for this so they could basically tell their own story and not be dependent on the mass media at the time, which was television and print media, to tell their story. Because in Mexico, the way that the Zapatistas were represented in most of the mass media was very manipulated. It was many times completely incorrect, you know, making them out to be kind of this armed guerrilla movement that was just about violence and, you know, kind of ignored the larger discourse that the Zapatistas were trying to have with Mexican civil society and really international civil society. The thing that was really interesting about the Zapatista movement, and I think it really was kind of the last movement in many ways that could function as it did was its appeal to broad international civil society, right? It's really before the internet was really functional. And although they used the internet to announce the uprising, but all these people from all over the world came to collaborate with the communities. And it was really an energizing moment. Certainly for me personally, it's like I look back on it and I'm like, wow, that was a really unique moment in time that I was able to be part of, that is not, I don't really know if it could ever be repeated again because the circumstances are so dramatically different in Mexico and in the world in general.
Yeah. So what would you say is the goal and point of such production?
Well, I think, you know, for my experience in working with video with and media with indigenous communities, it's really about self-representation and being able to tell your own story. Now that's completely possible. And now it's really moved away from this kind of anthropological, academic framework, you know, where academics go into indigenous communities and write books or make films or, you know, kind of analyze this foreign culture. Now communities can tell their own story. They don't even need to do it with video. They can just go on the internet and make a website, you know. So really, I think that's the principal use is self-representation.
Yeah, that's what's happening right now, actually, with Palestinians.
Well, cell phones, you know, video technology on cell phones now, and the way that the internet functions, that you can stream live, has completely changed. It's changed, actually, the whole, you know, discourse around human rights. Because before, you know, you were lucky if somebody shot video of something that documented it. You know, you would never, it would be impossible to have something live as it was happening, right? So now it's a very different, although on the other hand, now because of technology, there's deep fakes. You know, you can completely make something that looks real that isn't real. So it's really unknown territory for me. Like, you know, I really worry about that. I really worry about, you know, how we decide where the truth lies, how we're going to be able to really distinguish reality from completely made up facts and images. I don't know. I mean, I think about it all the time. I'm very interested in artificial intelligence and how artificial intelligence is manipulating images and kind of the way that, I mean, even with the internet in general, the prioritization of English language information and, you know, that, I mean, that's something that we talk a lot about when it comes to the archive is, you know, how is this historic memory going to be stored? You know, how is it going to be accessed? You know, where English language is a priority and a lot of the footage the community shot are in Mayan dialects, right? Is it just going to be erased?
Do people, the Zapatistas, do the media production themselves and how they are engaged into the media production except just making videos?
Yeah, I mean, since we don't really work with the Zapatistas as an organization, they definitely still, you know, have video cameras and are making videos. They use the internet quite a bit. You know, text messaging and, you know, just communication in general. They had radio stations also, and I don't know kind of how the radio is working now. Basically, what's happening is Zapatistas are completely reorganizing themselves. because of the fact that narco-trafficking in Chiapas has become so dangerous for them, they're unable to really protect their communities. So they're decentralizing their organization. And kind of my understanding is that communities are going to have more autonomy, that it's not going to be, you know, they got rid of the juntas de buen gobierno, which was like the good government councils, the caracoles, which were like these, you know, central locations where people gathered. So all of this structure that we had been working with for many, many years has been dissolved. And mostly because of the insecurity in the region, you know. So it's really, it's a big question mark. What really is going to happen? Because up until recently, you know, narcos didn't really incur in Zapatista territory, but now they are. And, you know, these are heavily armed people. And it's not a problem just in Chiapas, it's a problem throughout Mexico in different parts. So it's really unclear what really is going to happen. The other thing that's interesting about Chiapas that has really changed is that now cell phone signals are much more accessible in the communities where we used to work than they were. And it's only really in the last couple of years. And, you know, one thing that we really worry about, that the communities worry about, is that the way that cell phone technology is being sold in Mexico is that it comes in these different packages, right, that are tied to social media apps. So, you know, a lot of people in Mexico are very poor, so they can only afford the most basic data package on their cell phone. And so let's say the most basic package, you get data and Facebook and WhatsApp, right? So now they're starting to consume social media, right? And social media, again, is not focused on indigenous culture or indigenous languages or really progressive social movements. It's influencers, it's narco culture, right? It's West, you know, the global North, celebrities and culture. And so this is what's now coming into the communities. And so a lot of youth are, you know, replicating what they're seeing on their phones and disengaging from the culture within their communities. And so this is like, this is just what we're seeing. I have no answers to this. It's just like a big red flag that that needs to be addressed in one way or another. And I have no idea how that is going to, I mean, it's universal. It's a universal issue. It's, you know, endemic in the United States, ubiquitous. It's everywhere, right? With the youth. So, but that is kind of, in terms of technology, kind of the latest development that really is impacting the communities in, you know, in a very specific detrimental way.
But it also brings possibilities.
Right. It's a two-edged sword, right? It just depends on how you use the tool, like with everything, right? But you have to have the ability, I think, to understand what you are looking at and where it's coming from. Because it's very addictive, right? If you get on TikTok, I mean, I don't use TikTok, but I've heard, you know, people can spend hours in a day just scrolling through TikTok videos, right? And the way the algorithms are set up in all of these social media apps, it's about consumerism, consumption, you know, spending money, capitalism. It's not about protecting indigenous culture. So, yeah, it's a tool.
Z Aleksandro Halkin je govorila AKG.
Pač. Yeah. RS Interview.